Cliff Central.
The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.
Hello, hello. Okay, so last week we did a parody of a document published by the Department of Non-European Affairs in 1962 to facilitate relations between white South Africans and their Bantu servants. And we kind of made it into a joke because it reads like a joke, but it isn't really. And that's kind of the mind-blowing thing, is that this was a real government document published 54 years ago in apartheid South Africa. And 54 years ago is nothing. It's less than a lifetime. You know, my mom is, what, in her late 60s? So this is mind-boggling to me. And I always think, gosh, you know, there exist South Africans who have lived through two completely different eras. But I guess you never have any real concept of that. I've never seen a document like this, right? So my concept of apartheid South Africa is what was taught to me in history.
Yeah, me too.
In high school. And this stuff was never, ever taught. Well, for obvious reasons, because either we would have cracked up laughing or we would have been enraged, right? We would have been so, like, completely traumatized as kids.
Yeah. Or I wonder, because at the same time, I wonder how normal this was. You know, if this was just a normal government document and this was handed out and this was a sense of normal, then how enraged would we have been? You know?
If I'd had to think, right, that my friend's mom, when I went to her house, saw me in the way reflected in that document, right? Because it was her generation. It would have been her and her parents, right? Who were indoctrinated and who consumed everything in there. And really it was brainwashed. But anyway, if I had realized the gravity of the perceptions white South Africans had about black South Africans as a child, we were oblivious, and there was that buffer period around reconciliation and the Rainbow Nation and, you know, all of the kind of PR management that happened around the transition, and, you know, everyone was kind of pacified. And that's it's kind of that facade, I always say, that's starting to come off now, to wear off. Mm-hmm. But at least for me, like, I'm glad, man. I'm glad I didn't realize those things.
Yeah, I agree. And I guess why I was actually so happy to have found this is because it's nice to know what we need to deconstruct.
Yes.
You know, I didn't know what was being fed to white South Africa back then.
Yeah.
You know, we just knew, and we could speculate and we could speak from our experiences.
Yeah.
But it's very nice to see it written down. You know, this was, but in a way, a strategy. It was a strategy.
It's,
you know,
also crazy how sanitized our history has been.
Yeah.
I didn't know. Like, I thought I knew apartheid history back to back. This thing shocked me. Like, it really moved me. I was, and still am, in awe. You know, and almost the only way, and this is part of why, at least for me, it was helpful to start with this as a joke, like a parody.
Yeah.
Right? Because that's kind of become the only way I can come to terms with history and with a lot of things that happen in the world, is I've got to, like, sieve the seriousness out of them and, like, laugh hysterically. I literally, like, treat reality like a satire, and that's the only way that I can palette it or engage with it, you know. And that's kind of like the power of comedy for me.
Yeah, I actually find that I don't do it so that I can take reality in well. I rather do it so that those that feel attacked can find it easier to manage.
I guess it's a bit of both.
Yeah.
So where on earth, Tuliza Cindy, did you dig this thing up?
It's actually an amazing friend of mine, whose name I won't mention, but she...
Wait, hold on! Wait, is she a descendant of the Department of Non-European Affairs
she might be.
Of 1962?
She might be, yeah.
Is this, like, one of her family's artifacts?
I'm not sure how she
That's
found
hysterical.
It.
Yeah. Who do you hang out with,
knows?
Girl?
Girl, ain't nobody got time to be explaining my friend circle. But yeah, so she found it very interesting, and she's a white South African woman. I didn't actually quite ask her how she stumbled on it, but she just sent it to me and she said, "Oh my goodness, you have to see
this."
She
thought it's time to expose the family heirlooms.
Exactly, and it's so nice to actually get it from someone that is grappling with this as her own history. It's
incredibly bold of her.
It is
to want to debunk it, you know, because I think that at least must be part of the pain, is that, you know, gosh, the forefathers of white South Africans and the architects of
apartheid
were fathers and grandfathers.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I take so much pride in my family history and in my grandparents and what they did. But imagine having now this very kind of conflicted, very contentious feeling inside you.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, one of the things that I think we had to establish, sort of the climate of our conversations that we had to establish, is that we've all inherited this thing, right? It's not that they are just victims and they are just culprits. You know, we've all been thrown into this thing that makes no damn sense.
Yeah.
And sometimes we find ourselves defending or supporting things just by virtue of being from that lineage.
Yeah.
But, you know, and it's because of feeling like blame is implied or sometimes explicitly said, you know?
Yeah.
And what I've really enjoyed about my conversations with her is that she and I have sort of written ourselves out of it enough to very, I guess, objectively to some extent. I mean, it always remains subjective to a large extent, but to at least objectively explore certain constructs that have been fed to us, you know?
Yeah, sure. And I think what you've explained to me about terms like whiteness and blackness that I was skeptical of before, right? That I... And we won't go into that.
Yeah.
but I just felt like... I felt like, first of all, they were vague and they were very blanket terms, and I didn't realize what the value was in them. And I very much, as a black person, wanted to be treated on an individual basis. But if you talk now about grappling with constructs, right, and how it's really important to write the individual out of it, because I think we're in a stage in South Africa where we take things so personally.
Absolutely.
And we take our own lineage so incredibly personally and maybe our own indoctrination as well, so incredibly personally. Whereas I've always said, look, no matter what our role or our position is in South Africa at the moment, in large part we are victims of our socialization and of a system of indoctrination. We mutually need to say these are systems that we were mutually indoctrinated by.
Yeah.
You know? And where do we go from there without attacking one another?
Yeah.
I don't know if that sounds idealistic.
It isn't. I keep trying to imagine what creates extremisms, you know? So like, I think it was you that might have maybe introduced me to this term, but moral bigots. And I think it's like the constant denial of someone else's reality.
Yeah.
When you have to rephrase and reframe and find all these different unique ways to insist that your reality is true. You know, I think that's the frustration. If space for the reality won't be given, then you have to create it.
I just hope that ultimately our pushback as people will become more of a systemic one and less of a personal one. And I think it's difficult. But I really, really wish we would, you know, stop playing the man instead of the ball. I really do. And it's, look, it's easier said than done, right?
Yeah.
Because like you're saying, it's hard when it's your reality. You know, it's your day to day, not to take these things personally.
Yeah, but at the same time, we know that it exists because of individual realities, you know, that come together to form a collective reality, you know. So, again, a Black Lives Matter situation, for instance, there's enough of those deaths in those ways happening for it to now be seen as a systemic condition. But the one person had to be highlighted and the other one person had to be highlighted.
Speaking of, what really strikes me about the first part, the introduction in this document, is how it talks about how these are a sort of moral breakthrough, right? And what's scary, really, really scary to me, is that these guidelines, this document was an effort to humanize European and Bantu relations.
Yeah.
And they really do believe it, which means if you can actually conceive of this, which I mean, my mind has been blown ages ago, but if you can conceive of this, this means that the situation before these guidelines was worse.
Yeah.
The fuck? Dude.
It would be so interesting to understand how the relationship was that this was needed.
Right? This, yeah, like, emergency moral intervention. And I think the thing is, like, we always think about morality as such an objective thing. When in fact, it's quite relative to the norms of the time.
Yeah.
You know?
And I mean, that's why there's like a lady from America who did all these racial experiments, and her name's Jane Elliott. She's quite amazing. But she always explained how we are born into a racialized society.
Yeah.
And she was speaking directly about America, but I think we can also sort of apply some of her theories to here. But she was saying the only way that you wouldn't be conditioned to be racist,
yeah,
or to think racially is if you failed high school dismally, because in the high school teachings and the primary school teachings, you're so conditioned to understand things in a very prejudiced way.
Mm.
And so if, you know, that's your sort of, you know, compass, mm, that's also what your moral compass gets founded on as well.
Mm. The other thing I like about this, though, as much as it scared the life out of me, it really did.
I think you said that like 3 or 4 times now.
No, dude, legit. This is post-traumatic stress. but I think there's a tendency among us millennials to think that everything is unjust, like absolutely everything. And whilst things may be to some extent, we still have to put this country's journey in perspective. If at very least to realize how exponentially change can happen.
Definitely, you know what I mean? Definitely.
Because I think sometimes we feel stuck when we're not. In fact, the human condition is improving.
Yeah, I agree. But I think it feels like the things that create change are the things that are the most criticized by far.
Mm.
And so you sort of sit in a very, very uncomfortable position because you know you have to do it because that's what creates change. But at the same time, that is where all the backlash comes in.
Hashtag made sessions. Sorry. Who was that?
Yeah, so it's a very uncomfortable position.
This country is very, very good at discomfort, though. Like, I will say that.
Oh, I don't think so. I think we're good at denying.
I think it's a combination, right? But that's why we're good at it, because it's a combination of those things, right? It's kind of being good at discomfort via denial. But also, I mean, look. I was watching The Daily Show and Trevor said this over and over again. You know, the beauty about South Africa is that we have these conversations openly.
Yeah.
And we have these fights and it's uncomfortable, but I don't think we've reached the point of being PC that other highly racialized societies, the US, for instance, have. You know, I don't think it's as sanitized here. I think there is a rawness still. And because it's because it's still such recent history, right?
Yeah.
That we still have like a fighting chance. But also, the other thing, I think South Africa is incredibly, for better or worse, is incredibly resilient. And it frustrates me sometimes because I think we're resilient to a fault.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then we realize, oh no, flip, we forgot some like critical steps and we have to go back. Mm. And our attention span is so short.
It's really
but I mean,
short.
That's a global thing, right?
Yeah.
And when it's compounded by like South Africanness, you know, much like whiteness and blackness, I guess there can be a South Africanness. Then it's very interesting. But I think, like I'm saying, it can be a weakness, and it makes you realize in a country like South Africa how exponentially things can change.
Just as you sort of speak of blanket terms like blackness and whiteness and
South Africanness.
I mean, even if you look at this document, it basically had two races. It was the European and it was the Bantu. Mm. And that's all there was, you know? And that sort of spoke to the legal nature of the blanket, you know, that legally we were all blanketed. You were white, you were black, you were colored, and you were Indian, you know? And that's why, I guess, when speaking about these constructs, it's not an easy thing, but it's, I think, something to be explored, because, you know, if we're dealing with the way that it was constructed, then that's sort of the angle at which to possibly look at it in order to address the de-blanketing of an entire group of people.
Yeah, but I think actually what's important here, and almost to contradict myself, you know, something can seem digested because it was ingested.
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think there are probably subtle ways. In fact, there definitely are subtle ways where I see this document and all the ridiculous constructs perpetuated therein, right? I can see them manifest themselves in very latent ways in present-day South Africa.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's kind of what I kind of want to talk about that a little bit, because I almost want to go through it and do some analysis and say, okay, can we figure out in what ways its contents were ingested, right? In what ways do they still manifest themselves in present-day South Africa? In kind of sneaky ways where, like, we think we've evolved, but we haven't.
Yeah.
You know, and we think we're resilient, but we're not.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, I want us to honestly say where we have actually legitimately progressed. Like, let's just go through it and talk about what's fact and what's fiction in South Africa in 2016.
So really one of the most interesting of all, I mean, there were a lot of interesting parts, but really a very interesting part was with women and how in tribal life a woman's always regarded as a minor and she remains under the tutelage of a man. Mm. And then, you know, it sort of describes how, you know, how she has to be towards her male servant, that even the male servant somewhat gets to be above her just
it's
by
crazy,
virtue
right?
of her being a woman.
It's crazy,
which
right?
Which was crazy. Mm. I never imagined that.
Mm.
And then it makes me wonder today if, because to be very, very honest, like a lot of the white women that I've met seem to always be very apologetic and sort of make themselves smaller than they are, you know?
Mm.
And I wonder if this sort of conditioning had to do with that, you know, the idea that she is below everyone.
Yeah, so that's interesting to me. Because it first of all explains why they no longer are male domestic workers, because it was obviously for them far too much of a conflict of interest or a conflict of inequality.
Yes.
Right?
To work, yeah, beneath, to work for someone beneath them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So in a society with entrenched patriarchal values, then certain roles must be gendered almost first and foremost before any other inequality.
Very interesting.
It's quite fascinating that they would, I mean, there is nothing more unequal. No power dynamic is more skewed than that of a servant and a master. But for them to then build in guidelines on how to uphold or to honor patriarchal values within that.
Yeah. Where is the limits to your mastery and where is the limits to your servanthood?
Exactly.
Yeah,
and that's not to say necessarily that patriarchy always comes first. I think, like, there's always a cocktail.
Mm.
So I think, I guess the best way to describe it is a persistent tension.
Oh, interesting. Because it makes makes me wonder if the fear of a black man might have to do with that, you know, that sort of authority that was placed.
Yeah, on that could be part of it. But also, like, don't you find... So, people think racism is the most consistent ism.
Yeah.
I don't think it is. I think sexism is the most consistent ism. I think it applies to all forms of inequality. It applies in institutions, right? It applies in the home. It applies in religion. It applies in race.
Mm.
It's like the overarching...
Yeah.
...ism is sexism. Because maybe if we resolved all these other ones, that would be the one that would still persist. I think it might be. Because even if... Think sexual orientation, right, is the one place where that thing should be fluid.
Yeah.
But even between a gay couple or a lesbian couple, right, the role of masculine and feminine are still at odds.
Yeah.
Nuts. Nuts.
And I did always used to wonder how that can still exist if it is a same-sex relationship. I never quite understood that. So it's very interesting that it could be an ism. Or the persistence of that ism.
I also think what you're saying about that authority then, translating. Because I didn't know what parts of... Because, you know, black men in this document, I think, are referred to much like beasts. They talk about feeding, for instance.
Yes, yes.
Right? And it wasn't just black men. It was just the Bantu, I guess.
Yeah.
So you touched on fear, the fear that now prevails around the black male figure.
Yeah.
Is that based on something patriarchal, or is that based on something kind of more primitive?
Because, like, if you think about it, like, I think there might have been maybe an overarching, like, consensus that white men are above women. But the idea that a black man, even though he is black, could still be above you, it's almost like it makes his power even greater.
That's
because
really
it's
good,
almost like
man.
He supersedes the thing that is supposed to make him lesser.
Yo. Dude, that's so intense!
Which makes him even more powerful. It can make him perceived as even more powerful if he can supersede something that's so... obviously lesser, you know, I mean, according to that time.
Very
so
fascinating.
And also very funny was, like, you know, call them by their names.
I mean, jeez. How benevolent, how very, very kind. And it's just crazy that these people actually believed this as they were writing it. They thought they were doing the right thing, but I'm not going to reinforce that again, but it really messes with me. So this explains why never appear in front of a male domestic worker in a state of undress. Never allow him to handle underwear or to wash sheets that you've soiled, probably referring to menstruation, right?
Yeah.
What else? There were other things. Never leave him in the care of girls.
Yeah.
Or never leave girls in the care of your male domestic. Yeah, exactly. Mm. And these are all the things now that are very inherently, in my opinion at least, inherently exploitive about domestic work today.
Yes, absolutely. But look at how they phrase it, and especially with the man. So when they talk about, you know, don't expect him to make your bed, wash or iron your underclothing.
He's absolved.
But it says... It outrages his sense of what is proper.
And that speaks
to the beast.
Exactly.
And then on top of that, you know, it speaks to, like...
But because he's a man, he's also absolved of all these things.
Yes.
Which is why... I mean, this document is saying, by virtue of these things, that they, in a sense, are an abuse.
Yeah.
They're not right.
Yeah.
And therefore, the black male domestic is absolved.
It's so ironic.
And so, to this day in 2016, they still fall on the black female domestic worker.
Yes, because for her it is not wrong.
Because she isn't the right gender.
Yes.
So now let's talk about food. Food was very interesting to me. Because... I think certain principles still apply to this day. What's under the food document is still largely, and I mean like the foods that are mentioned, are still largely what would constitute the average employer's grocery list for their domestic workers, I think.
Yeah.
Actually, I kid you not.
Yeah, no,
for real. And it's so normal, and that's not just white employers by any means. That still just constitutes the staple diet for a domestic worker in any South African home. I think that's a cross-cutting stereotype.
And it's actually the staple diet that I've seen with construction workers. Mm-hmm. So those that sort of do hard labor.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So the food we buy for the help is always so classist. And even the food we buy out of charity. And that's kind of the interesting thing for me, is you're paying someone to do a job, but you still take a charitable stance towards them. Yeah. Even though they're providing you a service. By taking that charitable stance, what are you saying? Are you saying you're not paying them enough? Because they have a job. You see what I mean?
Yes.
This is not a poor person.
Yeah.
Who is in need of charity. Technically, if you have a job, you should not be in need of charity.
Yeah.
And still you take this very charitable stance because you acknowledge that they have less, right? And so, for instance, you'll never buy a helper quiche, right? Because it's considered middle to upper class. That applies across the board. That's something we've all ingested. And actually, probably what domestic work did when it didn't change in 94 is it actually spoon fed the rest of us a lot of these values that are just so outrageous. Anyway, you always buy her the cheapest things because you think it's what she's used to for some reason, but you'd never buy those same things for your PA or even your au pair.
I
kid you not.
And it's very interesting because you say you'll buy her the things that she's used to. And then as I read here, how it says difficulty may be experiencing in persuading servants to eat the latter, but they should be encouraged to do so.
Yeah.
So imagine then if year after year after year after year, there's encouragement for these foods to be the norm, then what else but that becomes the absolute norm.
And then you think you're being empathic because this document thinks it's being empathic. It's looking out for the Bantu, right?
Yes.
The Bantu's nutritional needs. So please encourage them to do so because it's good for them.
Yeah.
And then you start to think that.
That it actually is,
This is the standard. And it's a good standard, no less.
Yeah.
And you think you're being empathic, but you're not.
Yes. Shame. That's hectic,
yeah. You know what I mean? So this is the kind of system that would pervert empathy, pervert morality.
Yeah.
So there's so many people still in this country who must genuinely think that they're doing the right thing. Guys, yo. But they're not. But how would they know?
But, you know, I guess at the same time, that is why it is very important that there is, I guess, the safe space to speak about these things, because if someone does genuinely believe that they're doing the right thing, they need the space to be able to be wrong, because it wasn't like they were malicious in intent.
It's true. And like I said, it's something we all do. And really, the solution is so simple. Why not just ask them?
Yeah.
If you don't know, don't guess.
Definitely.
Right?
Definitely.
What they need and what they're used to. Why not then just ask them?
But I mean, honestly, if you've got such a shopping, like a very concise shopping list, why ask? Because you were told that, you know, 54 years ago.
Yeah.
And also the other interesting thing I thought was the last phrase, Bantu are used to taking their time about their meals.
Damn right.
Don't expose us.
I'm sorry, what was that?
I'm supposed to speak against it.
Okay. I retract.
But I did find that interesting because it was quite a blanket statement about all of the Bantu. But it also implied a sort of laziness and, you know, an apathy.
That is probably the one that I liked the most. I didn't get that from it. Maybe because it applies to me, like 1 hour lunch for who?
You're right. You're right, but
I was like,
no, but if you've got an hour lunch, you're not taking your time, you're taking your lunch.
That's true.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it doesn't need to frame the Bantu in that way.
I don't know. I that was the one that didn't offend me. I thought it was like,
I'm not offended.
Astute.
I just thought it makes us sound lazy. Okay. Damn.
No, it makes us sound like we value meals and we value rest and connecting and, you know, I think these are not, I don't know.
I guess I'm literally imagining how this would be perceived in the context of this document.
Yeah, okay, you're probably right. I'm probably romanticizing it. I'm making it about connection.
We love nature.
I'm making it about leisure and rest.
I'm sure when they were reading this, they went like, oh my God, let's learn a thing or two from these people that enjoy enjoying their meals, you know? But
oh, please. White people are desperately trying to be as unbusy and unstressed as black people. They must lie.
One of the other very interesting things I thought was, you know, in language communication and their recommendations for it. So they had said that it would go quite a long way if the non-European learns the Bantu language, but if they can't, they should.
I don't know.
I know. Yeah, mm-hmm. they should adopt Fanagalo.
What is that?
I still don't know what it is.
What Fanagalo is,
and I don't understand why we don't know anyone who speaks Fanagalo. Does that mean no one cared? No
very,
one.
Very strange.
No one took that advice.
It's very strange
because we know a lot that speak Afrikaans.
Yeah.
You know, so I think Afrikaans a lot of times was,
yeah,
you know, the main language used between.
I think if this wasn't such a racist document, that would have been a good principle. Because I do criticize a lot of white South Africans for being here forever and not learning native languages.
But is Fanagalo a
I don't know.
Language?
No, but I'm saying.
I don't know what the hell that is. I don't
Fanagalo aside, just the principle behind
yes,
that.
I agree.
And I don't know, I don't think they meant it in that spirit, right? I just, you know, they probably meant it, this is just like, if you want to communicate efficiently,
yeah,
learn the Bantu's language.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with that. In fact, I thought that was very, I thought it was very endearing.
It is, right? Yeah. It's almost like if you want to curry favor with him.
Yes, exactly.
And I don't have the document in front of me, but what does it say?
So it says, use a language he understands reasonably well when giving instruction. And then... But it really, it touches on the connection that it makes. It says you'll create goodwill towards yourself and your family.
Exactly.
If you're able to speak his language. So that was a very beautiful gesture.
It is that sentiment. It isn't purely functional.
Yeah. And then it didn't say, and if that fails, then use Afrikaans or the one you're comfortable with.
Yeah.
And it said, get
keep almost, going almost, yeah, until you like, reach Fanagalo.
Yeah, get a commonness there going. So you're both on the same footing with Fanagalo. Yeah, very interesting.
Oh, the other thing, yes, that slayed me in accommodation, is, guys, why are servants' quarters being fumigated? There's just like... Do you want to read that part?
It says that inspections at irregular intervals to see that the quarters are clean, together with regular fumigation or spraying with DDT or similar insecticides, should be resorted to.
Keep going.
Where on earth do they sleep while all of this is happening?
Okay. Keep going.
And then separate bathing facilities, a bathroom or shower cubicle, if at all possible, a decent-sized galvanized bath being the minimum, plus soap and other disinfectants should be supplied.
What are these people living in kennels that they're being fumigated, disinfected?
You know, I never even thought of that, but as you say that, I didn't.
So they do. They actually think straight up that black people or Bantu people are beasts. Because, like I said earlier, under food, they refer to feeding as opposed to eating.
Ooh.
Exactly. But now, to this day, let me tell you, friend, people are afraid, and I'm not going to make it a black thing, but let's make it a poor thing, a poverty thing, right?
Yes, it is quite a poverty
People are afraid of poor people's illnesses.
Yeah.
As though they were somehow more fatal or infectious than rich people's illnesses. And it can almost be the same thing, right? But, like, for some people, and for some reason, there is something far more horrifying about a poor person with AIDS as opposed to a rich person with AIDS.
Yeah.
You know, they almost feel like just from basic contact, they can catch it. And that's what a lot of employers feel nowadays towards their domestic workers. Mm. And which is weird because illness doesn't discriminate. But for some reason, it's almost like people are more terrified in government hospitals. I am.
I am too. Yeah, girl.
Do you know what I mean? But the hospital is a hospital is a hospital. I don't know.
Is it?
But even if it's so strange because, like, I don't know if necessarily that, I don't know necessarily that poor people have much worse diseases.
I completely agree. I think, and this is now a very personal thing that I imagine. It's not necessarily that it's a fear that I have, but it's a thing that I imagine. Mm. That if, say, a rich person had AIDS, they might maybe have access to a good nurse if that's what they needed, access to all the right medication, access to all the amount of visits that they need, if they need to do any sort of blood tests, that, you know, all the right equipment would be there to make sure that nothing, you know, slips out. Like, there's maybe a meticulousness that comes with money that maybe at, you know,
but you could still catch it.
Yeah, definitely. But I think you trust the meticulousness more. But
the thing is, we know the ways in which HIV AIDS is transmitted, and even so, like, you can't, you know, despite the level of care or treatment that person is getting, you're still going to contract the same HIV/AIDS. So the treatment really speaks to their own health and not to yours.
Yes, definitely, right?
So why do we still think, where people of a certain class are concerned, sharing facilities with them, toilets?
Yeah.
And this is a part of it, you know? We've spoken to domestic workers where they're like, first of all, the minute they start to cough, it must be HIV/AIDS. We know that they're being asked for HIV/AIDS testing, which is unconstitutional. Yeah. We know that.
Yeah.
It's happening. And it's not just the white people doing it either. We know that too.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we've spoken to domestic workers where they're not even allowed to wash their clothes in the same washing machine. They have to hand wash their clothes.
Yeah. I think, the paranoia has definitely made us do really, really strange things, like the washing machine stuff. But I think it's definitely founded on, I guess, no, it's not. I'm lying.
I was trying.
You
were doing so well.
I was imagining some things, but I think the gravity of our paranoia is actually quite ridiculous now.
The hours of duty have not changed much at all.
It said that it must be remembered that the domestic servants are human with social, recreational and other interests, and provision should be made for time off to enable them to follow these pursuits. Did that mean that they didn't have time off before that?
I don't know. I know that this message still applies to employers in 2016. So keep going.
Absolutely. And as a general rule, it says that duty hours shouldn't exceed 10 hours per day with suitable breaks in between. And in addition, domestic servants should be allowed a free day from about 12 noon onwards once a week, as well as a free Sunday afternoon on alternate weeks.
So I don't know when we all agree that domestic workers don't get weekends, guys, but we did at some point, right?
Yeah.
And whenever we speak to these ladies, they have to check if we need them to do something on a weekend or a public holiday. They've got to check.
Yeah,
if
absolutely.
They can get off.
Yes. It's mind-blowing. If you can't, if you have no free time to go and access, you know, a platform like this, for instance, at which point do you get to tell your story? And, I mean, I guess this I found a little funny. The kaffir beer.
The kaffir beer, yes.
As they call it.
But they make it out to be such a sacred and a spiritual and a religious...
Which I also think was a little respectful, actually.
Thing, which it isn't at all. It's just a bunch of people getting drunk. But okay.
But they literally said their traditional national drink. Is it? Is it
drink? It's not my national drink.
And it says that it plays a very important role in the religious and social life of the Bantu. Religious?
I'm sure they... it's possible that we justified it that way. To ourselves, even. Like, guys, booze is. Getting drunk.
It connects me to my spirit. Yes.
This is like Jesus and the wine.
Oh, gosh. And he says, it says that it's imperative that he should be placed in a position where he can obtain this most...
It is imperative!
It's imperative that he can be placed in a position where he can obtain this most important beverage in a legal way. Were they getting it illegally? What was going on?
Friend, this must have been a means also to pacify their servants, right? Because alcohol does that.
Yeah, it really does.
And this is something still quite prevalent, I think, in certain cultures, certain African cultures, definitely, where like alcohol is often used to pay for land.
Oh, really?
Yeah, instead of money.
What? Oh, okay.
For certain transactions. Yeah, if somebody has helped you, particularly where men are concerned, if someone has helped you to move in, you buy them.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Beer.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
And that's like an official thing. And people will almost ask for it.
Very interesting. Why do you think that is?
I don't know.
Why does it's ultimately a strong currency then?
It is. It is a currency. Alcohol is legit a currency, which, I mean, is another conversation. Okay, well, that's it for me. Like I said, look, it reads like a parody.
It does.
I think most of what is funny, though, is the semantics. It's the words, you know? Mm. And if you kind of unpeel what it's saying and you dig into the principles, many of them still... more or less, in some ways, still apply today.
Yeah.
But I think, like, ideologically, intellectually, there's no person in 2016 who wouldn't think this is ridiculous. But then we must interrogate the...
I wonder.
Okay, let me not say there's always someone.
Yeah.
Or there are people. But in general, right? Yeah, from an intellectual point of view, this is unheard of in 2016. Mm. And so I think intellectually, we've definitely... evolved. What is interesting now to try and figure out is this juncture between our evolution as intellectuals and our practices.
Yeah.
Right? As human beings who are self-interested.
You know why I struggle to believe in our evolution, although we have made significant progress. If as humans we can still see another human as not human, I do always question how much we have evolved, you know, because all of this, you know, as you were talking about, you know, the beastification of the black man, like, I don't quite see it as any different today, you know?
Do you see, but people get their panties in a knot about you using the word made, right?
Yeah.
And they'll be very indignant and they'll attack you because they've never used that word.
Yeah.
But it is definitely far more important that you do not treat her that way.
Yes.
But they don't connect the two.
Yeah.
And that, for me, is the danger here. Mm. It's like, we've done a lot of intellectual window dressing.
So we're very politically correct.
Yeah.
Now. Yeah.
But come on, guys. You know? Real talk.
Yes, please.
Okay. And on that note, we, through this process of engaging domestic workers on their realities... have been writing a couple of insights, and really all we are is scribes, because we can't, you know, in many ways relate to their experiences. But what we've finally done is we've put together a letter. It's called Dear Madam, and it's to the proverbial South African madam, who is anyone. It's not just a white woman, guys. It's anyone with a domestic worker.
Yes.
Okay. So I don't want people to divorce themselves because it says Dear Madam.
Yeah.
But we've shared that this week on social media and in a blog post. And it's very much, it's a letter for these women, by these women. It's not as serious as all that, because actually they don't take themselves too seriously either. They've always got this air of forgiveness and jovialness and love about
humor,
them, and you know, and really everything they've said is incredibly constructive, and I encourage everyone to read it. It's called Dear Madam, and please share it as well. Tools.
Yeah, absolutely. You can find it on our Facebook page. You can find it on our Twitter page. And if you want to look for it, it's maideprojectblog.wordpress.com.
M-A-I-D-E.
And there is humor to it, but we're actually really explaining it as they've explained it to us. They've often explained it to us with a lot of humor. It's really quite funny.
But don't laugh it off either, right?
Absolutely.
So enjoy the humor, but actually try to engage with everything that it's saying, because the principles are incredibly important. And I think they apply more or less to some extent in every home with a domestic worker. There's something in there for absolutely everyone.
Yes, that's it. It's got all these different sections. So some might not apply to you and some might. But I think it's overall just really worth a read.
And it's almost a response to this discussion and to this document called the Bantu Servant and You. It was an unintentional response, but, yeah. You know, it's a chance for you to hear their point of view in 2016.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for joining us on the Made Sessions with CliffCentral.com. Twitter?
Please follow us on Twitter. It's at Made Project. That's MAIDE Project, as well as our Facebook page. You can type in the same thing at... Oh, no, it's not at. Just Made Project, and you'll find it.
Have Amanda! Oh. Let's try it again.
Thank you for indulging us. And, yeah, have a very good evening.
Amanda!
Away wait, too.
Cliff Central. The revolution. I've got something important to tell you. CliffCentral.com.